From WBUR Boston, this is Here and Now, a daily digest of news and culture.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Verizon Wireless, working to constantly strengthen the connection quality and reliability of its network. Verizon Wireless, our people, our network.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, what the class of 2011 is reading, a growing trend for summer book assignments for incoming freshmen. One school has a disaster theme. But first, the word on Wall Street is bleak. Stocks worldwide have fallen sharply for a second day in a row, even though today the Federal Reserve joined central banks in Europe and Asia in pumping massive amounts of cash into the financial system to try to stabilize things. The worldwide problem is due to risky home loans here in the U.S., and the trouble is, no one really knows which banks are in trouble. The stock market sell-off began yesterday when the largest French bank stopped investors from taking their cash out of funds caught up in these risky subprime home loans. Well, we turn now to Mark Zandi, chief economist with MoodysEconomy.com. And Mark, we want to start with an interpretation of that last sentence. Can the French really do that? Just tell investors you're stuck with losing funds?
Yeah, any financial institution can do that. It can say that you can't redeem your investments in our institution. If you do, we will have a problem, so we're not going to let you do it.
Right. We've spoken before about the cause of all of this, the sinking mortgage market with people unable to pay their mortgages because they don't have fixed rates, or the rates are rising, or maybe they had bad credit, shouldn't have gotten the loan in the first place. As a result, there's less money in circulation for other loans, for business deals. But are there downsides to the Federal Reserve and other banks just pumping money into circulation?
Well, not at this point. I think because institutions are having a hard time getting cash because of this crisis of confidence, if that continues on for very long, that becomes a very significant economic problem. So I don't think there's much of a downside now. I mean, there is an argument that you might be bailing folks out, but that's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater at this point.
Well, how bad is it on day two?
Well, it's bad. It's a problem. I don't think it's an economic problem if it ends soon. But if it were to continue on into next week, then I think there would be economic consequences. So, yeah, it's a problem.
Well, we mentioned that no one knows which financial institutions are holding these bad funds, risky home loans. Is there a call for more transparency?
I think so. I think the advantage of our financial system is that it diffuses risk. It takes risk and it throws it all over the world, and that's what we're seeing. That's why we're seeing these problems in Paris and in London and in Singapore. That's a good thing because it distributes the risk more widely. But the disadvantage, obviously, is that we don't now know who bears the risk. And I do think that does argue that in a global context, we need to have more information, better information, more timely information.
Mm. Well, what do we say to people who say, well, I don't have stocks. I don't have a lot of stocks. So how does this affect me? How does it affect everyone else?
Well, everyone's touched. I mean, if you're in the house, if you own a home, it's going to affect you. You can't refinance, or it will be hard to. You can't take a home equity line, or it'll be hard to. Your housing value is going to be lower in most parts of the country. And if this were to continue on for a few days, and it did begin to affect the ability of businesses to raise cash to finance investment and hiring, then of course that's a problem for everybody. Jobs is key. So This is going to affect all of us in one way or the other.
And how much is it affecting the U.S. in particular, given that it's the U.S. Bad loan system and these loans then that get sold? And as we've said before on this program, it used to be that you got your mortgage from one bank and it stayed with that bank till that house was paid for. But now these loans are sold and sold and sold, bundled into funds, and as we've just said, they ripple overseas. How is this impacting the U.S. in particular?
Well, the U.S. is suffering the most right now because it's weighing very heavily on our housing market. About half the mortgage market is effectively shut down. If you're a subprime borrower, a so-called Alt-A borrower, a jumbo loan borrower. Yeah.
But it's further realization, and you and I have spoken of this, that much of the debt of the U.S. is held by other countries.
Yeah, that's not a matter of concern for me. I mean, I think that's actually an advantage, a plus. It means that we're all into this together, and we've got all the same incentives, and nobody wants to see somebody else's economy get hurt because they've got a stake in your economy. So I think it's an advantage that the risks and the ownership of securities are distributed across the globe.
Well, you may not feel that way if, for instance, you're in France. Mark Zandi, chief economist with Moody'sEconomy.com. Thanks so much for catching us up today.
Thanks so much.
Well, staying with spending for just a second, in between buying mini fridges, extra long twin sheets, and new laptops, this year's college freshmen are also, sometimes frantically, reading their summer book assignments. More and more colleges are requiring summer reading for freshmen. So today, our conversation about the books shaping the class of 2011. Joining us is Katie Comboy, professor of English and vice president for academic affairs at Stonehill College in Easton, Massachusetts. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Robin Mara is professor of political science at Franklin Pierce University in Ringe, New Hampshire. Welcome, professor.
Thank you.
And George Panichas is professor of philosophy at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania. George, welcome to you as well.
Nice to be here.
And I just want to ask, first of all, a student at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota, did a survey of more than 100 summer reading programs, and he found that most of them were new, just been started in the last 4 years. I know your schools have been doing these for, 8 to 10 years, and others have been doing it for decades, but any thoughts on perhaps schools just coming to this? Professor Comboy?
Yes, I think this is true. I've talked to a number of chief academic officers at other colleges and professors who have asked me, what have you used in the past? How has it worked? And seem to be curious about how to get something started. And I've also noticed that literary agents have recently picked up on this, and I'm getting more and more materials from those agents saying, here's some ideas for summer readings, and we can also arrange the campus visit of the author if you're interested in that kind of thing. So I see more and more of this happening.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think the very reasons that probably many of us are doing this, to build community, to create a kind of common ground with our first-year students, to perhaps create a connection to a story of self-discovery. Those are the same reasons that most colleges want to do this. There's more and more of a sense that coming to college is something that is a great journey that the student is undertaking, and that this is the first step in that journey.
Well, let's take a look at those steps, the books that you guys are assigning. Professor Marr, I'm going to start with you over there at Franklin Pierce in New Hampshire. What were some of your picks?
In the past, we've used Fried Green Tomatoes by Fannie Flagg, Black Ice by Lorene Carey, Granny D's book about walking across America, and this summer we've chosen Three Cups of Tea by Greg Mortensen.
And that's one man's mission to promote peace one school at a time?
Correct.
What's that about?
He was a mountaineer who failed in his attempt to climb the second largest, tallest peak in the world, and wanders into a remote Pakistani village and discovers that they have no educational facilities and promises them that he doesn't know how or when, but he'll be back and he'll build a school. And this was in 93. And as of today, he's built or had built over 50 schools throughout northern Pakistan and Afghanistan.
So obviously these are, countries that are in the news, countries you might want your kids to know more about. But of all the books, all the books that are out, why this one?
It raises the whole issue of what do we mean by community and what is the individual's responsibility to being a member of a community. It raises issues of diversity. It internationalizes or globalizes their experience. And it's a compelling read. It's a great story, and it shows that one person can make a difference.
Yeah. Professor Panichas, that book seems to underscore what we're hearing about why these books are assigned, that it's more than just about reading a story. You're there at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania. What is your assignment?
The reading assignment for us for the summer is John Stuart Mill's famous essay entitled On Liberty. 1 year our students, incoming students, read Homer's Odyssey. We've also read plays, Richard Frey's Copenhagen, and on one occasion we used a film. We used Crash. Well, we selected Mills on Liberty for some rather interesting reasons. This year is the 250th anniversary of the birth of the Marquis de Lafayette, after whom the college is named. And we were reading various things around which to organize the events of the year. And we read Mills' eulogy of Lafayette, in which he praises Lafayette for having led a life of liberty. And so we organized the year's activities around lives of liberty. When the dean of students, who's responsible for the selection, requested nominations of the book, On Liberty came to mind quickly because we would have an opportunity to introduce students not only to a year-long celebration of the life of the Marquis de Lafayette, but also to the the works, probably the most influential work of the person who wrote a powerful eulogy about him. On Liberty is an important essay for a variety of reasons, one of which plays to the theme for the incoming students, and that is the value of liberal arts education. John Stuart Mill provides a robust defense of two things that are indispensable to liberal education, and that is freedom of expression and free inquiry. So for those reasons, as well as the issues regarding community, we thought On Liberty was a very, very good choice.
Well, and you've sold me. I mean, you know, you really have. But I'm wondering, you know, you're competing with Robert Ludlum. Or whoever's writing Robert Ludlum's books now, you know, mm-hmm. because he's passed and others are writing his books and they're on the screen. And, you know, I do you think about that? Because it sounds as if you're going straight ahead with your goal and your mission and you're not trying to, you know, make it easy for them. You're not trying to, you know, say, gee, how can we entertain them and get them to read?
No, that's exactly right. We're not trying to entertain them. I think one of the aims that we have is to bring our students in into a community of persons who care about ideas and are willing to work hard to gain some measure of command over them. I mean, you know, this is a very difficult and very engaging essay, and we would like them to have an experience which is not tied to the classroom, which is not tied to an outcome such as will I get a grade. But it might be helpful for me to explain that what we do is we have the students read the book, and then we divide all of our incoming students into a relatively small number, and we have faculty who are volunteered to participate, lead discussions on the book over two sessions during the orientation period.
Wow. I mean, this is a big effort.
It's serious.
Yeah. Professor Comboy, what are your students reading this summer?
This year, our students are reading Ishmael Bey's A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier.
And this is
a book.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a book about a young man, really a boy, who finds himself caught up in the violence in Sierra Leone, something he never anticipated in a relatively happy and peaceful childhood. And then really discovers what inhumanity he himself is capable of. And I think that that's something that it's important for students to kind of recognize, is that they will be making choices and that we can help them to think about the kinds of institutional priorities that we have, with an emphasis on social justice, an emphasis on global and interdisciplinary learning. And reading a text like this can help them to think as well about a process of self-discovery, the process that all 18 to 22-year-olds, and that's primarily the cohort that we have at Stonehill College, that's part of the journey that they're on, deciding who they will become.
That's Professor Katie Comboy of Stonehill College. Our conversation today required summer reading for freshmen. And here's some more, because we've been hearing from you. Bentley College here in Boston sent their list. The Age of Ego Casting, that's an article in The New Atlantis by Christine Rosen. They want their students to read a chapter in Stephen Levy's The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness, and The Machine Stops. That's a short story by E.M. Forster. All pieces that look at how technologies change our lives. Occidental College in Los Angeles requires Bird by Bird. That's some instructions on writing and life by Anne Lamott. And Choosing Civility, The 25 Rules of Considerate Conduct by P.M. Forney. State University of New York, the College of Environmental Science, assigns Richard Liu's Last Child in the Woods, and they say be prepared to attend an all-campus discussion on the book. By the way, send us what you are reading if you're a freshman, or if you are an advisor, a professor. Send us your college reading list at here-now.org. We've got some more here. The University of Washington assigns Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change by Elizabeth Colbert. And Smith College has assigned Persepolis, The Story of a Childhood by Marjan Zatrapi, a guest on our program here. More after a break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more of our conversation about summer reading assignments for college freshmen. I know one freshman who is thoroughly enjoying The Book of Sarahs, A Tale of Adoption by Catherine McKinley. That was assigned by Sarah Lawrence. And we've been speaking with Professor Robin Mara of Franklin Pierce University in New Hampshire, Professor Katie Comboy of Stonehill College in Massachusetts, and George Panichis of Lafayette in Pennsylvania. Professor, let's start with you. Your students are reading John Stuart Mill's On Liberty. You know, but what with Facebook, iPods, you've got competition. Do kids read the book?
my experience has been that you can depend upon a certain number of students to have done the reading, to really made an effort to try and command it. What we do is we establish a mechanism of internet communication, a Blackboard and the rest. Students can send in questions. Our incoming students can send in questions about the reading. We have persons, faculty members staffing it, and they can answer and they can respond. You can always depend, there'll be a certain number who won't take the assignment that seriously, but I think when you're coming into a new environment, when you want to make a good impression, when you're going to a highly selective, small liberal arts colleges such as those that we represent, you're going to get participation. My experience in conducting the discussion on these courses is that the students are ready when you enter that room to talk about it, and some of them show up with a long list of notes. So I suppose there are other things with which we compete, but I don't think we're losing the competition.
I mean, I wonder, too, Rob Amaro there in New Hampshire, according to the New York Times, the winner this year, I mean, the book that more schools are giving out or assigning, and in one case, one school did buy thousands of copies, 7,000 copies of this book, the University of Florida, and handed it out. It's Tracy Kidder's Mountains Beyond Mountains. It's a book of Dr. Paul Farmer. It's subtitled A Man Who Would Cure the World. Dr. Farmer, of course, fought tuberculosis in Haiti, Peru, Cuba, Russia. And following that is a couple of other books, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, that's about autism, and The Kite Runner, of course, Khaled Hosseini's book about Afghanistan before the current conflict. And I'm just wondering, it seems as if the shift, and a lot of schools have said they are shifting from, kids having some internal awareness through their reading to having some sort of global awareness. Would you, though, not assign a book about Iraq because it's so politically hot an issue?
The book we had used last year was Barack Obama's Dreams from My Father, and several faculty raised the issue of whether we might tacitly be seen as endorsing Obama if we used it again. So that set us off looking for a different text. And part of our mission at Franklin Pierce is to get students involved on a global basis, if only in terms of their awareness of issues. They don't have to be out there fighting the front lines, but so we were looking for a text that would show them what is possible and what has been accomplished. For us, it was sort of an easy choice once we made that decision to move away from the Obama book.
Yeah, the rest of you, any thoughts on that? When a book becomes, maybe too political to be assigned, or
we haven't had that problem with a text that we've tried at Stonehill. We did use Tracy Kidder's Mountains Beyond Mountains 2 years ago, and it was a wonderful success.
Oh, are you saying you were ahead of the curve? Beating all these other schools.
Last year we had Paul Rusesabagina as An Ordinary Man. You may know that Rusesabagina is the actual hotelier of Hotel Rwanda fame, and he came to campus. And actually what happened was that we discovered, having had years when we brought an author to campus, years when we didn't bring an author to campus, and of course Lafayette will not be able to bring Mill to campus. And so that, there's one of the things that, that can't happen, although I love the idea of using a classic, and I've been really impressed with what you've had to say about where you're going with that. Yeah. But the idea of being able to bring someone and have the students actually encounter that person who's gone through that experience and who found a voice to tell the story about it, it was very powerful, and we decided that that would be something we'd try when we could to make happen.
This is Robin Mara again. I don't think a book can be too political in the sense that politics infuses almost every aspect of their lives, and to the extent that we can get them to recognize that and confront it directly, I think is only going to serve the students in the long run. They may disagree with the politics, but at least we'll force them or encourage them to develop the basis for that disagreement, and that will open up other conversations.
Well, I feel for the students of the University of California, Berkeley, because apparently the thinking there is that they ought to know more about global warming, and the theme of their reading list this year is disaster. So they're reading, here are some of the examples, Ecology of Fear, Los Angeles and the Imagination of Disaster by Mike Davis, Paul Ehrlich's 1968 classic, The Population Bomb, and William Golding's 1954, Lord of the Flies. I guess the other thing, these are incoming freshmen, so maybe, you have that other job of getting across that there are big problems in the world, but you don't want to, discourage them from even showing up. on the first day.
I think it's important. This is George Panichis again. I think it's important to realize that the selection of the book is going to be very much a function of the kind of institution you are and what you can do with it. I think that Professor Morrow is absolutely right, by the way, in saying that a politically controversial book is likely to be enormously successful, if for no other reason than because it'll provoke precisely the sort of conversations that are important. But the University of California, Berkeley, is not going to be in a position, given the size of an incoming class, to have their incoming students meet in groups of 25 with individual faculty members to discuss a particular volume. And I think so for those of us who are in small liberal arts colleges, we can do something that's rather distinctive, and we make our selections usually based upon that fact.
Robin Morrigan, one of the things that we're discovering is that more and more of our students are coming from educational experiences where throughout high school they've been asked to do summer reading. So this isn't as strange or novel a process for them. And for our purposes, you started off by saying how they're looking for mini fridges and things like that. The last thing they forget to pack is their mind. And so the book sort of encourages them to do that. And although that might sound flip or trite, that really is one of the things we're trying to accomplish, is that arrive on campus prepared to join our academic community.
And think. That's Robin Mara, professor of political science at Franklin Pierce University in Ringe, New Hampshire. We also spoke to Katie Comboy, professor of English and vice president for academic affairs at Stonehill College in Easton, Massachusetts, and George Panichis, professor of philosophy at Lafayette College there in Easton, Pennsylvania. At our website, we'll have, as much as we can, compile a list of summer reading. But we want to thank you all for sharing yours with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And one last note, we just got an email from Andrew Mushnick, who's going to be a freshman at McDaniel College in Westminster, Maryland. Andrew, you're going to have the most fun. He says he's reading The Stolen Child by Keith Donahue, the story of the myth of the fairies that steal children and live their lives, the changelings. The author's going to visit his campus. Andrew, good luck to you, and I'm going to check out that book. More after a break, here and now. In November 2005, U.S. Marines allegedly killed 24 Iraqis in Haditha in Iraq after a roadside bomb exploded, killing a member of their battalion. Were those Iraqis insurgents, as many of the Marines claimed, or innocent civilians killed during a revenge-fueled rampage? Well, we've been hearing dispatches from the investigation into Haditha. Yesterday, the military cleared 2 of 8 Marines originally charged in that case. So today, we thought we'd get an overview of Haditha and another ongoing case in Hamdaniyah, Iraq, with Tony Perry of the Los Angeles Times. Tony, welcome.
My pleasure.
And let's start with Haditha. Just go through the timeline of what we know happened there.
Well, what we know happened is a convoy of Marines was going through Haditha, a town in the Euphrates River Valley, when a roadside bomb exploded, killed one Marine, injured 2 quite badly. And then in the next few minutes, the Marines in that convoy killed 24 Iraqis, including 3 women and 7 children. 5 Iraqis were pulled out of a cab, and they were shot to death. And then 19 were killed in 3 different houses as the Marines went through looking for insurgents. They found no provable fact that the insurgents had been in those houses, but by the end of the morning, 24 Iraqis were dead.
As the investigation began, what's the count of charges?
Well, when it all started, there were 4 enlisted charged with murder and 4 officers charged with dereliction of duty for not investigating more thoroughly for a possible war crime. You may remember this case didn't really come to light until Time magazine did a long investigative piece, and they suggested that the Marines' first story, that the Iraqis had been killed as part of a roadside bomb or part of a firefight, just didn't hold water and that they had died in a different way.
Well, now, as we said yesterday, charges were dropped against 2 of those 8 troops. Lance Corporal Justin Sharat, who was accused of murdering 3 Iraqi brothers, the charges were dropped against him. And Captain Randy Stone, who was a lawyer with the battalion involved, also saw his charges dropped. First of all, so why was Lance Corporal Sharat's charges dropped? What were the charges?
Charges were murder. They had gone through a preliminary hearing called an Article 32, and the hearing officer concluded that the Iraqi testimony, sworn testimony taken by investigators in Iraq, wasn't credible, that they didn't really see Sharat kill the 3 brothers, and that his story and that of other Marines, that they were clearing that house and suddenly were confronted by 1 or 2 men with AK-47s, seemed far more credible, Also, the forensic evidence didn't suggest an execution. So the hearing officer, particularly since the Iraqis wouldn't or couldn't come to America to be part of the hearing, he recommended that the charges be dropped. And yesterday, the commanding general, the convening authority, James N. Mattis, he agreed and dropped all charges.
You mentioned something that's become real obvious in this investigation. It is very difficult to get Iraqi witnesses to the U.S. to testify.
Well, nobody's done it yet. It's also very difficult to get the Iraqis to allow exhumation so the bodies can be examined to be and the results can be used in these sorts of proceedings. So gathering evidence in these things is very, very difficult. The first outside officer that looked into Haditha said that the military really ought to do a lot more investigation, but he warned that it will be very, very difficult to find prosecutable evidence. We've now had one of the officer cases dropped, one of the enlisted cases dropped, a second enlisted case had already been dropped in exchange for his testimony. So we started out with 4 and 4, and now we're down to 2 enlisted and 3 officers.
Why else are Iraqis difficult as witnesses?
The U.S. has a policy of paying condolence payments, and there's been testimony that once you start paying people for deaths, suddenly their tales of how those deaths occurred may be impacted and become less credible in military court martials. So that's a problem. There is a tendency of the Iraqis all to glom onto one story that may be the story given out by the tribal leader, the sheikh, or the neighborhood leader, and you can't really shake them from that. So they don't make very good witnesses.
We wanted to touch on another completely different case. This is in Hamdaniya. This is when 7 Marines and a sailor were charged after an elderly Iraqi man was taken from his home and killed. Troops were accused of planting a gun on him, trying to make it appear that he was an insurgent. What's the status of that case?
5 of the troops, 4 Marines and a Navy corpsman, all pled guilty. 4 of those are out of the brig already, have served their sentences. The 5th may get out by dinner time today. That leaves 3 who went to court-martial, all convicted. And in each case, their jury was comprised totally of Iraq veterans, Marines who'd been over there. All 3 were convicted, but in 2 of the cases, the juries said time served is enough, and they were freed that very day. The sergeant, the ringleader, if you will, Lawrence Hutchins, was given 15 years and a dishonorable discharge. His sentence will be reviewed, as all the sentences have been, by Lieutenant General Mattis, and he has the power to overturn guilty verdicts. He has the power to decrease sentencing.
Well, as you just said, one troop sentenced to 15 years, but others released. Some would say that shows leniency. What's the thinking on that?
Very hard to figure. The jurors were warned not to talk, and they haven't talked. But I think one can presume that because they were Iraq veterans, many of them had combat action ribbons. Those are what you get when you've been fired on and had to fire back. They know what it's like. They know the moral complexity. They know the very difficult circumstances that young Marines, young corporals find themselves. Now, the Marines in that case, while what they did was clearly illegal and unauthorized, will tell you that they did it to send a warning to insurgents to stop attacking the Marines, stop attacking them with roadside bombs, stop attacking them with snipers.
Is that one of the things that's also on trial in these cases as well? The fact that this is not a frontline war, this is a war against an insurgent enemy that doesn't play by the same rules.
Exactly, and Lieutenant General Mattis, in kicking loose 2 of the Haditha defendants, pointed that out, that this is an insurgency that does not follow any ethical rules of warfare, that hides behind civilians, that tries to draw fire towards civilians. And that's the sort of thing the juries who've served, who are veterans, they know without even being told. So if you're looking for a reason for the verdicts as they were guilty, but in 2 of the 3 cases kick loose that very day, it could be because they know how very difficult, how very morally and tactically complex Iraq really is.
And just one last quick question. Terrible cases, and there's a handful of others, but how does the war in Iraq compare to past wars, Vietnam, for instance, in terms of these kinds of charges against U.S. service members?
It's a handful of charges. I think it's probably less per capita than Vietnam. In terms of the difficulty, it remains. It was difficult to get the hierarchy to investigate in Vietnam. It can sometimes be difficult in Iraq, difficult to convict enlisted in Vietnam, difficult to convict them in Iraq. And once sentencing is passed, the tendency in Vietnam was to decrease the sentence upon appeal. Some 20-odd Marines were given life imprisonment for killing Vietnamese during that war. No Marine served more than 12 years.
Tony Perry with the Los Angeles Times, thanks for bringing us up to date and giving us some context. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay, before we go today, Israeli jazz artist Anat Cohen has not one, but two new CDs. You'll hear them, and you're listening to Here and Now. The art world has been a Twitter ever since a conservator at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts recently took an X-ray of Van Gogh's The Ravine and found underneath it one of his earlier paintings, Wild Vegetation. Well, earlier this year, and just over the river in Cambridge, Massachusetts, another scientific analysis of art caused a stir. Researchers at Harvard University tested three paintings that had been attributed to the abstract expressionist painter Jackson Pollock, and they found evidence that questioned the age and authenticity of the works. The owner immediately dismissed the findings, saying the process was more art than science. But what is the science of examining art? Here in Now's Emiko Tamagawa paid a visit to the lab of Narayan Khandekar, senior conservation scientist at Harvard University Art Museums, and began by asking him about the lab's findings.
We looked at a variety of pigments across three paintings that we examined, and we found in all cases that there were materials that were not available during Jackson Pollock's lifetime.
And this, of course, was the thing that set everybody off. I mean, they said things like, you know, maybe varnish contaminated the pigment.
In the types of analyses that we do, varnish does not affect the analysis of a pigment. We did interview the person who restored the paintings, and he told us very clearly what it was that he had done, and his account tallied very closely with our own observations.
The equipment that you use here, is it special to art, or is it your basic sort of scientific chemical analysis equipment?
We use whatever we can to give us the information that we want. Much of the equipment that we use will help us characterize the material we're examining, and it will give us a fingerprint, if you like, of the material we're looking at.
What do I see here? I see many, many little vials, and I see the sort of automated arm that seems to pick them up and put them places. What exactly does this machine do?
This is a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer. It will take a complex mixture of materials, pass it through a very narrow column to separate them into individual components, and they will then be passed into the mass spectrometer, and we can identify those individual components. And it's an important thing to understand because the artist makes very careful choices about what he or she uses to paint with. So this is a great way of understanding the selections the artist makes.
This is liquid nitrogen?
Yes, it is. And we use this to cool the detector in the FTIR, the Fourier Transform Infrared Spectrometer.
What does that piece of equipment do?
We take a very, very small amount of material, and it is pressed out on a diamond cell. An infrared light passes through the diamond, through the squashed sample, and will give us a spectrum. And we can then compare that spectrum to a library that we have. Here you are. Here's a sample from a painting attributed to the Master of St. Cecilia. You have silver leaf applied with glue to the gold background, and then you have transparent red paint with silver flakes in it.
What's amazing to me is that this is just a sample from this painting, but in a way it looks like art in itself. The colors are beautiful.
That's one of the great things about making cross-sections. Every time I do it, I go, wow. The colors that I'm talking about here on the actual painting are very obscured, and they're quite sort of muddy looking, so it's very hard to tell what's going on. When you look at it in cross-section, suddenly it all becomes clear. You can see that it was once a bright red, and there was gold involved as well. So it really gives you an amazing insight into how effects were achieved, what the effect once was, and what the artist might have intended.
After 15 years of looking at art scientifically, Does it still have magic for you?
No question. If I didn't love art, I would not still be doing the work that I'm doing now. One of the great pleasures that I have is going to an art gallery and wandering around looking at the art on display. And when I go to galleries in an unwork-related way, I try and leave the science at home and just look at the art.
Harvard researcher Narayan Khandekar speaking with Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. Coming up, jazz musician Anat Cohen, Here and Now. Thirty-two-year-old Israeli Anat Cohen was just a girl of 12 living in the seaside city of Tel Aviv when she picked up the clarinet and began playing, of all things, Dixieland jazz. Inspired by her musical family, she later took up the saxophones and expanded her repertoire to Hebrew folk tunes, Brazilian choros, and opening up songs like this one, La Comparsa, originally a Cuban piano piece. That's one of a wide range of songs on Anat's new CD, Noir. It's recorded with the Anzac Orchestra. Another CD, Poetica, features Anat playing songs on clarinet with a smaller band and strings. Cohen is taking a moment to speak with us before the Newport Jazz Festival this weekend. Welcome.
Hi, Robin. Thank
you. Well, first of all, congratulations. Boy, two CDs and a whole bunch of critical raves to go with them.
Yeah, this is very exciting times.
It should be. We want to head off any confusion first. We've already spoken on this program with the Israeli bass player Avishai Cohen. Not to be confused with your brother, the trumpeter Avishai Cohen, right?
Exactly.
He and another brother are on Noir. What were the musical influences? Because we understand your dad lived in the U.S. for 10 years. That may have been how you got to some of your American music passions.
Most definitely. My mother also, for a brief moment, lived in the West Coast. So they both have a big love for the American songbook. And obviously, Israel is a young country, so the music of Israel is not, I wouldn't say developed, but there's a lot of imported music from different places in the world. So the music that they like to listen to, beside the old Yiddish songs, the Great American Songbook.
What were some of the things you listened to, and what did you on your own pick out?
I know my parents, they always they like to listen to Elvis Presley, and there was definitely Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett. My father had a record of Bing Crosby. Different sounds, a lot of singers, definitely. So that was my first introduction to jazz, which was basically hearing the repertoire.
You know, we didn't hear much about Bing Crosby, the klezmer years. And you do have a really strong klezmer influence. Is that something that you studied, or does it just come through your pores?
It's very interesting because a lot of people comment about the influence of klezmer in my playing. Obviously, in my clarinet playing, nobody commented about the klezmer in my saxophone playing. I think probably because I did hear it growing up in Israel. So not intentionally, it is part of what I do. I think the influences are definitely there when I play whatever style of music. If I play the music of Louis Armstrong, someone will come to me and say, "Do you play klezmer?" Or I play the Brazilian choro. Someone will come, "I heard some klezmer. Is this klezmer?" So
let's hear a little bit of the clarinet on your CD, Poetica. This is Agada Yapanit. Have I got that right? Japanese tale?
Agada Yapanit, yes.
It's from the Israeli composer Ariel Silber. You write in the liner notes that you've been more drawn to the clarinet over the past few years. That would be drawn back, I guess. What's bringing you back?
I think the various styles of music that I got to play and the different people along the way that I met in Boston, when I still lived in Boston.
You studied at the Berklee School of Music?
Yes, and Berklee has a lot of international students, and I met a lot of different friends of mine that are from other places, from Venezuela, from Brazil. This perspective of living far away from your country makes you want to sometimes explore the music for your country. So all these people started to bring their music and combine it with jazz, and I was lucky enough to be at the right place at the right time and explore with them the different sounds of South America.
Well, let's hear some of that international influence. You cover the Cape Verdean singer Cesaria Evora's song Carnival do São Vicente. It's en noir. Let's hear that. Anat Cohen, what do you do here? Because Cesaria Evora has such a distinctive voice. Are you trying to capture her voice with your instrument, or go away from that?
I think with the clarinet, the nice thing that the clarinet has such a rich range, and you can really play either use the low range of the clarinet and use the low voice of the person, or play very high. And Cesaria has such a deep voice and is so distinctive that it's very hard not to try to imitate. So I'm trying to capture the spirit, the way she sings, the way she floats with the phrases back and forth, and the whole feeling of the song.
Well, and in some cases, I'm thinking of one in particular, at least one critic said it was brave to cover, John Coltrane's Lonnie's Lament on clarinet. Let's do this. First, let's hear a little of John Coltrane's version. And now let's hear your version. This is on clarinet. Anat, I read that your brothers grew up playing Coltrane, but what led you to this song?
I heard the song, I heard Coltrane's version, and like many other John Coltrane songs, it really got to me, the sincerity and the depth of the music really got to me. It's very soulful, it's very true, and I've loved this song ever since the first time I heard it.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Well, you know, heady times. As you said, you finished school in 98?
Yeah.
And now you're being compared to a master by none other than Nat Hentoff, who's covered, you know, all the masters since the 50s. He said when he hears you, he hears the hard-blowing Kansas City tenor Ben Webster. And here here are young female Israeli. How does that feel to be compared that way?
Well, it's a great honor. Of course, Ben Webster, like many other of the great tenor players, have been with me since the first day I picked up the saxophone. You cannot play the saxophone, the tenor saxophone, without acknowledging the history and understanding that the great masters like Ben Webster, like Lester Young, Sonny Rollins, like Dexter Gordon, a lot of people on the way between, before, after, some people that are more famous and some people that didn't get as much recognition. There's a lot of great tenor players, and all of these people, once you hear them, they just forever stay with you. Mm.
Israel's Anat Cohen. She's got two new CDs, Noir and Poetica. She's been speaking to us from the Argo Network in Manhattan. And for more on her upcoming schedule, including the Newport Jazz Festival, go to our website, here-now.org. Anat, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.